Welcome to Amazon Legends, where we have real stories about making it big on Amazon. Our guests are CEOs of large companies and entrepreneurs who became power sellers. Also providers specializing in helping sellers, aggregators that acquire sellers, and former Amazonians will give us an insight from behind the scenes. Here is your host, Nick Urison.
Welcome to another episode of Amazon Legends. You don't want to miss today's episode because we're going to get real into the things that take all the money. And if you're not right, we'll just be spending your money without getting any return. So my next guest is someone who did the most boring job, like HR in construction business, offices with no windows. That's where he started. But he discovered tech startups. And when he did that, he decided to get into tech and specifically online advertising and with Google Ads. And of course, that led him to Amazon PPC. And today he's the co-founder of Ad Labs. So anybody who is doing HR work in construction business in offices with no windows, there is future. So he's the co-founder of Ad Labs, a semi-automatic bid optimization platform. And the reason why he ended up creating it was because he couldn't find anything that would do the job that was good enough. So when he's not spending his time with that, he's very busy with his high activity dog and skateboarding with his dog. So with that, everybody, meet my guest, Stephen Now. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you, Nick. Glad to be on here. Thanks for inviting me. And yeah, I forgot that I gave you all that background on me. So it's quite the introduction. That's basically my whole life. So not much more to know about me or anything that I do.
Well, you know, we go through life with these experiences and, you know, we suffer through them, we get knocked down and things happen, or we do things that down the road turns out that really they were indicators of what we were going to do. So, you know, these experiences are not unique. You know, others are having them all the time. So that's why I'd like to put that background in terms of what led you here, how you ended up doing what you're doing. And somebody listening out there, you know, you never know. It's maybe another version of you. So so that's exactly why it gives a good perspective. So what we're going to talk about today is optimizing bids for keywords with low or no data, which is pretty much everybody's problem, especially at the beginning. But as they discover, you know, whatever is going on, still it's not enough. So tell us, how does one go about optimizing bids for keywords with low or no data?
Yeah, well, I will just say, fair warning to all the listeners, this topic is going to be a bit technical, and I'm a bit of a geek on this type of stuff, so I can err on the side of being overly technical. So I'm going to start off by giving you a really short kind of version of the answer, and then we can dive into the weeds. But the short version of it is I'm a big proponent of the bidding strategy known as revenue per click bidding, which is basically looking at a keyword's sales divided by your clicks and then multiplying that by your target ACOS or dividing it by your target ROAS. Either one is going to be the same. And then that's going to be how you calculate your bid. And so when it comes to these low data scenarios, you know, you've got a keyword with one click and one sale or one click and no sale, you know, what do you do in those scenarios? Does this still work? And I'm here to say, yes, it does. But we just have to do some other kind of workarounds and ways to get additional data. And so I think we have some good systems that can be helpful for everyone listening.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to translate everything you say. Okay.
Yes. Perfect.
So also, I may need translating myself, so I'll ask some questions. So we'll clarify everything if needed. So first thing that you said, sales divide by clicks. Mm-hmm. That pretty much gives you dollar value every click. Now, these sales are not your total sales, are they? They are your paid sales.
Correct. Yeah, these would be the sales per keyword. Sorry, I probably didn't clarify that. It'd be the amount of sales that the keyword is driving. So if you got that keyword, and you're like, what should the bid for this keyword be? You're looking at the sales that keyword has attained that are, you know, according to the advertising attribution as well. And then you divide that by the clicks, the amount of paid clicks that, that you achieved.
Okay. Now let's dissect a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Paid sales generated through sponsored products?
Yeah, it applies to everything. Everything that's using a CPC model, whether you're doing sponsor brands, sponsor display, sponsor products, anything that's on a CPC model, cost per click model, you want to be looking at the revenue per click. And the reason for that, I think, should be, you know, it should kind of click and make sense. But if your goal is to, if you're thinking about like your ACoS or your ROAS is a certain like spend to sales ratio threshold, then obviously on a cost per click platform where you're paying for every click, like all of that spend comes down to a click by click basis, you have to be trying to hit that threshold properly on basing it off of the sales per click or the revenue per click. So we're trying to kind of keep the spend and sales proportionally to where we're profitable or whatever your target kind of return on advertising is. And so we're trying to hit that on a click by click basis, which is how we use that to determine our actual keyword bids.
Okay. So that means that your paid sales combined across all campaigns, sales divided by total number of clicks times ACoS, right? That's the number.
Yeah, that would be if you were looking at the revenue per click at a, like a total account level, which you can do too. And I do that a lot of the time too, to figure out what should kind of, you know, that'll give you your average revenue per click for your whole advertising account. If you're looking at all of your campaigns combined, and from there you can figure out what your average cost per click should be again for your whole account. And that can give you a good that's a good informational data point to figure out like, what should my starting bids be? You can start there. That's a great way to kind of get that data. But I'm talking more specifically about drilling this down, taking the same logic down to the individual keyword data. So if you're ever looking at a specific keyword, you're doing this on like one keyword at a time, doing this same formula.
Okay. So, but not every keyword generates sales.
Exactly. So that's where we get into the question of what do you do with these low data scenarios?
Okay, so what happened was, so let's make this simple. Okay, you generated 10 clicks. Let's say make it a running sponsored product only.
Yeah.
You generated 10 clicks across five keywords.
Yeah.
And you generated $10.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Your revenue per click is $1, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Except that it's only two keywords that generated those sales.
Yep.
So now tell us, how do you apply this approach when you drill down at keyword level?
Yeah. So the way in which I like to do it, and there's really, at the end of the day, if you have a keyword with one click and no sale, is that good or is that bad? Like, I think that's the question. Before we actually dive into the answer, I want to ask a couple more questions. That's one. If it has one click and no sale, is that good or bad? You know, or two clicks and no sales, is that good or bad? You know, obviously, it's neither good nor bad. Although what I think is it actually really depends on kind of what the bid is. If you have a couple of clicks, and let's just say they're spending $5 a click or $10 a click, you know, it's only a couple of clicks, but obviously you're spending way too much if, you know that on average you can't afford that because you're looking at that total account kind of level and you know you should only be spending like a dollar. You know, a $5 CPC is too much. So even if it's just one click and a $5 CPC, that one keyword's not killing you, but if you have 1,000 of those keywords, and they can even be much lower, right? They could just be spending 50 cents. But if you have enough of those non-converting keywords in aggregate, that's going to really start bleeding your account. And this is where I've seen a lot of folks actually run into issues, is they just have, you know, maybe in an account with like a million keywords, to pick something extreme, 10 of those keywords are doing really well, good volume, good sales. And then the rest of them are all in this super low data scenario in which they only have one click and no sales, but cumulatively it's killing the account. So the way in which we're going to try to solve this problem is we need to come up with basically a reference or a benchmark revenue per click. And so here are the challenges. How can we find the most relevant revenue per click to this keyword that we can use as a reference and kind of use that as something that will be a safety rail so that we're not, you know, increasing these bids beyond what's actually affordable. So I think there's three ways to do that. And Two of them are I'm not a fan favorite of. I really like the third option that I'll present to you. But the main two that people usually do is number one, they just go for a longer time frame. So if this keyword only has like a click and no sales or whatever, and they're thinking I need a longer date range, they'll start looking back to last 60 days, last 90 days, especially if they're connected to like some other third-party tool that's storing this data permanently. They can look back 6 months, something like that, to really try to extend that date range to pull in some data. The only issue there is when you start using those really, really long timeframes, as great as they are for pulling in some extra data points, some additional clicks, they start tapping into other timeframes that might not be super relevant data compared to the current period, especially if you have products that have seasons through Q1 and Q2, you know, exactly. So I'm not a fan of that method, although that's one way. The second way is people will start looking to Seller Central metrics, and they'll start looking, you know, at this, you know, if this keyword is in an ad group with a specific product, they'll look at like Seller Central and start saying, well, what's the total kind of average conversion rate for this product, and try to pull that into calculated bid. The only issue there is that the product's conversion rate and the data attached to that product, you can't really, you know, if 100% of the traffic came to this product through branded search terms, you know, it's going to seem like the conversion rate's really high, versus if it came from non-branded search terms, it'll seem like it's really low. You can't segment it out. So the third way that I like to do is, rather than looking backwards in time, like I think rather than extending like horizontally to try to pull in more data, or trying to like cut across a channel and kind of do some cross-referencing, I like to do what I call looking up. So instead of looking back, I like to look up, which is basically looking at the parent entity of that keyword, which in this case would be the ad group. And the ad group there in total is probably, in my estimation, going to be the best benchmark for reference for this keyword's data, because that ad group is going to be it's going to be containing all of the average order value and the average conversion rate for all the keywords in that ad group, as well as all the products in that ad group. And yeah, I'll kind of pause there to see if there's any questions on that so far.
Let's see. Okay, so we're talking specifically conversion rate, but we are looking at keywords that generated clicks but didn't convert.
Correct, yeah.
So the ad group itself will have a conversion rate because some of the keywords would have converted. How do you determine? Because it's zero against something. So zero will always lose. So how do you determine from that?
Yeah, so the reason why I think this method works is because, let's go back to that example we were saying before, where if you had 1 million keywords, and just for the sake of simplicity, let's assume within this ad group, all of these keywords are pretty similar, meaning they're either all non-brand or they're all brand. You should be doing that. You should be like separating your brand and non-brand keywords at the campaign level, at least. And even getting more granular, you can do different stages of the funnel with these keywords, whether they're super long tail and bottom of funnel versus short tail, top of funnel. So it'll definitely be advantageous to you to, and this method will work a lot better if you do have that kind of segmentation. But even without it, it's still going to be pretty, you're going to get some pretty good results with this method. But if you have those 10 keywords, you said there were 10 keywords, let's say they're all in one ad group, one of them has a sale, the other nine don't. And let's just say all 10 keywords all have one click. So you got one with one click and one sale, the other all with one click and no sales. Traditional, I guess, wisdom would say, because all these other keywords are low visibility, for the last 30 days, they only got one click, we're going to classify them as low visibility. We're going to increase these bids by 10%, 15%, 20%, whatever it may be. And that's usually the end of the logic. And where I see that start to cause issues is you do start seeing these bids start climbing up into like the $1, $2, $5 range, as those like low visibility keywords aren't actually low visibility. They're maybe just low search volume. And therefore they're always only going to ever get one click within a 30-day window. And if you're just always kind of perpetually raising these bids ad infinitum, you're going to run into some issues. So how we're going to solve this is, yes, we are going to increase these bids, but we're going to have a kind of like a smart bid ceiling or a bid ceiling that's like using some intelligence here for where that's going to cut off. Because the other mistake I see a lot of people do is they'll just pick an arbitrary value, just like at $3, we're done. And they apply that at like the whole account level, But I think if we tailor everything down to an individual ad group level, we can be a lot more specific, because each ad group is going to have different levels of conversion rates, different average order values, all these kinds of things. So to kind of try to, you know, complete my example here, when you have these 9 non-converting keywords, you can raise those bids up to 10%, but you want by 10%, but you want to absolutely make sure that you don't exceed the ad group's kind of target cost per click. Because if you have one, so let's say you have one keyword here in this ad group, and it's got like a, let's say your target A cost is like 30%, right? And you have that one keyword, and let's just say that one keyword, it spent $1 and it got a $10 sale. And so it's doing pretty good. It's a 10% A cost. And you're like, oh, cool, I can raise the bid on this keyword because it's really low A cost. And you got all the other 9 keywords all also spent $1 with one click. But when you zoom out and you look at the total ad group, you're now seeing you have $10 of spend across 10 clicks that only got you $10 in sales. So the whole ad group is at 100% ACOS. And so this ad group now is telling us, okay, that's great that one keyword happens to get a sale after one click, but we know on average for this whole conversion group, for this whole ad group, the average conversion rate's about 10%. And because our average order value is around $10, we know that $1 cost per click is not affordable on average. And so what we would need to do is we would say, okay, well, doing the revenue per click method, right? That, you know, $10 in sales divided by 10 clicks, you're averaging about a dollar in revenue with every click. And if indeed your target A cost is around 30%, that would say that your average cost per click should be about 30 cents. And on average, out of every 10 clicks that you're getting, one of those is going to result in that $10 sale. And so then at the ad group level, you should be able to hit that. So what that basically means is that our ceiling here should be around 30 cents. You could sometimes double it if you want to give a little bit more flexibility, give a little bit more room for these keywords to run. But it's very, very important to at least be cognizant of what the individual ad group's kind of target cost per click should be, and use that as your ceiling. And maybe you can let your keyword bids go a little bit above that ceiling if you're really trying to see if this keyword's going to convert, things like that. So that's basically the method that I've been using, and I've seen some really good results on my clients for.
Okay. So just to recap, the way you calculate the ceiling bid is total sales divided by your paid sales divided by your paid clicks times your ACOS. That gives you the ceiling that you should assign to the ad group. And then the individual keywords, you should adjust accordingly. And you should never go above the ceiling when you are assigning. Is that the case?
Yeah. So here's the thing. In that example, that 30 cent cost per click, that's on average what our cost per click should be. That doesn't mean everything in there should be exactly a 30 cent cost per click, because you will have some keywords that perform better, that convert better than others, right? And so what I'll typically do is, and you know, if you really want to get granular with this, you can look at, you know, within, you know, all your keywords that have a lot of data, what's kind of the spread of conversion rate? Like how big is that? What's the mathematical scientific term for that? Standard deviation, which I'm not even sure if I'm using that word right. I've just heard that used, so I'm trying to sound smart. But you know, if the standard deviation on those conversion rates, let's just say like they can range in a difference of like 2 times, where your lowest converting keyword to your highest converting keyword, there's like a 2x difference. Then if you know your average cost per click should be around 30 cents, you can set the ceiling at double that, 60 cents per click is your hard cap ceiling, which is basically saying, hey, if one of these low visibility keywords happens to convert twice, 2 times as strong as our average for this ad group, we're going to try to make room for that to let us get up there in case if there's a keyword that performs twice better than average. And so, you know, that you could do that, but the whole purpose of this exercise is to prevent against these keywords getting up to a dollar. Cause what I'll hear people say is like, oh man, when this bid was at a dollar, I lowered it to 60 cents. I was trying to do what you said and I lost all of my visibility. Now I'm not getting any impressions, any clicks. And I'm like, okay, well, when it was at a dollar, you were losing money. So you're either going to be losing money or losing impressions. Like you can't, I'm sorry that I can't come up with a bidding formula that causes you to you know, get a cheaper cost per click and more sales simultaneously. That's not how it works. Amazon's a competitive space. You know, if you're in that environment, then where you can't basically afford, and I made up this example a couple months ago and I really like it, but you can't always afford visibility, right? Like I would love to drive around in a Lamborghini because all of the impressions I would get, to kind of draw on some marketing analogy, like all the eyes that would be on me, all the visibility I would get if I was in a Lambo, that'd be awesome. I can't afford a Lamborghini though. So you have to be realistic with what you can and can't afford. And so this keyword that the market price, the auction is pricing it at a dollar CPC to really get good visibility, you can't afford that if your target ACoS is 30%. So now you've got to make a decision. Are you going to raise your target ACoS on this keyword specifically, or on this product, or on this ad group, on this campaign strategy, whatever? That's a business decision you need to make if you're willing to invest a little bit at a loss, raise that target ACoS so that you can afford that additional visibility. Or you've got to go do something on your product listing itself, improve the product listing to improve those conversion rates, which will, you know, allow you to basically increase the performance of these keywords so you can bid more.
Yeah. Well, I'll share with you something. One of my guests said this during the podcast. He said, your advertising on Amazon is a triangle.
Yeah.
You have to look at it as a triangle.
Mm-hmm.
One side is sales. The other side is ACoS.
Mm-hmm.
And third one is time.
Yep.
So you can't have all three.
Right.
You have to take your pick on which two are you comfortable living with. So it sounds like this guy talking to you, he wants all three. So that's why, because he doesn't understand the model. So
right.
In the long term, that's a different situation. But when you are just starting out, or you are in discovery, or whatever the case may be, this is the triangle. So you have to decide, okay, what are you going to do? So if you want as much sales as possible, and at a reasonable ACoS that you can live with, well, guess what? It's going to take a long time. And at the beginning, you don't have that luxury. You don't have the time. So therefore, you have to give up that and then push the ACoS to push the sales. That's all you're going to do. And
yep.
Or if it's you want to hold on to the time, then obviously it's going to come at the expense of sales, right? You're going to lose sales, which is what this guy was doing. So you're going to get good ACoS, you know, during the time frames that you are measuring, but mm-hmm. your sales will suffer. So it's
right.
It's always the case. So, okay. So as far as paid sales, so, and you are saying that you do this calculation at keyword level. Now, one thing I want to ask you, you mentioned conversion rate. How do mm-hmm. you measure conversion rate in this case?
Yeah. Yeah. So conversion rate for Amazon ads, I do orders divided by clicks. So out of every, you know, if you get 10 clicks and one of those converts to an order, you know, one order divided by 10 clicks would be 10% conversion rate. And a lot of, I actually use revenue per click and conversion rate a bit interchangeably a lot of the time, because if you ever actually like kind of chart them out, if you take like a conversion rate over time and then revenue per click over time, the correlation between them is like 95%. And the only difference for that other 5% of when they differ is if the average order value changed. But if you actually take conversion rate and you multiply it by average order value, you get the same output as revenue per click. And that's just because the way math works, like, I didn't have a visual here. I should have pulled something up, but yeah, I mean, like, you know, orders divided by clicks for conversion rate multiplied by your average order value, which is sales over orders for average order value. Those orders are going to cross cancel each other or whatever the math term is. And yeah, you're left with just sales divided by clicks. So it comes out to the same thing, but that's why I kind of use revenue per click and conversion rate interchangeably, but usually I'll just talk about conversion rate when talking about like these different benchmarks, stuff like that, 'cause that's a lot more familiar with people. A lot of people understand conversion rate.
Orders divide by clicks.
Mm-hmm.
Are you talking about orders or units?
You could kind of do either one. I prefer orders just because that's what's displayed in the ad console on Amazon, and that's kind of their default is orders over units. So for me, it's just a little bit easier. It's Amazon's consistent with, they're always going to show orders no matter where you are in the ad console. They're not always going to show units. They sometimes show units. So I prefer to go with orders.
So I'm gonna actually give you I believe what they put in the reporting is they call it purchases and orders. Purchases being the number of orders, orders being the sales value.
You know, it depends on where you are in the Amazon Ads console. Like, I believe in DSP, they call it purchases. And then on the PPC side of things, they call it orders. So Amazon's very inconsistent with what they call things.
Just different people building these systems. But at the end of the day, you're not referring to number of pieces sold. You're referring to orders, unique orders
Orders,
placed.
yeah.
Okay. And I believe the total sales, because somebody may click on the product advertised, but they may end up buying a product that's not advertised from that click.
Correct.
It's gonna register to that particular click, right? So it's
Yep,
gonna show
correct.
up on orders. So, okay. So purchases divide by clicks. That's okay. Because do you ever look at the business reports, USP?
Yeah, in business reports, it's units session percentage. Yeah,
So do
their
you ever
version.
compare, and does
Yeah,
that come?
absolutely. Yeah, I do. I mean, the thing that's weird too is that I think it all kind of balances out because technically you could get multiple units, which, you know, if you're counting multiple digits of units, that would make it seem like the conversion rate's much higher. But also, it's going by sessions, and the number of sessions could be higher than the number of clicks. Like, you can have one ad click that leads to someone going to your brand store and shopping all of your products, and it could lead to 10 different detail page sessions from just one click. You know, so like, there are some places in the ad console where you can actually see the number of detail page views that were driven from your ads, and you could see detail page views divided by clicks to see on average like how many detail page views are you getting per click. And when I've run that analysis on clients, it's usually around like 1.5 to 2 on average detail page views or sessions or glance views. Amazon's not consistent on that. I don't know what they call that at all. So yeah, you can do, I do look at business reports too to pull in those metrics, but yeah. When I'm within the ad console, I usually just stick with what's available in the ad console.
So if somebody clicks on the same ad twice, that's recorded as two clicks, right?
Yep. I believe so. Now, I don't know if you click on the ad and then go backspace, or if you like open it in a tab and like you click it twice. I would hope Amazon has some feature in place that it won't like double charge the double count and double charge it. I think that's where they kind of have their, you know, Amazon, I think when they're tracking for bots to avoid like those black hat tactics where people are just spam clicking competitors to drive up their spend, burn out their budgets. Amazon, I think, is on guard for that.
Well, they have something that removes clicks. I forget
Yeah,
what it's called, but they
correct.
should. So,
It's like their gross and invalid traffic report.
yes, invalid traffic. So, but legitimately, same person clicks twice, legitimately clicks twice. That's two clicks that they pay for. In business reports, that's recorded as one session or two sessions.
At a minimum, 2 sessions, but if they continue to browse other product pages without clicking on an ad. So that's what I'm saying. Like if they continue to view other product pages without clicking on any more ads, that's where you can get more sessions or more detailed page views than you were actually accounted for clicks. And then same thing with those units. You could, if they purchase multiple units, you get more units than orders.
Yeah. How is the system tracking the same user going to other pages. Where does that appear?
I assume, I mean, Amazon's just using IP addresses, and if you're, especially if you're signing into your Amazon account. I mean,
in the report, so that means that, so let's say that a seller has three different products, and they clicked on the ad once and landed on one product page. So that's one session on that product page. And they went to another product page. That's another session, right? And then went to the third product page. That's another session. So it's three sessions. So in business reports, there will be three sessions. But in the advertising report, there will be one click, right?
Yep, correct.
So that's what I was referring to. So that it would show up in business reports. But you really have no way of connecting the dots and say, okay, so these clicks generated X number of sessions. There is no way to associate. Okay. Well, it does get complicated. So, so let's go back to what you were talking about. So, and the subject is optimizing bids for keywords with little or no data. So ultimately, what you are going by is you're looking at the ad group, per ad group. You're looking at the total sales in that ad group, divide by total clicks times ACoS. That's giving you an indication. And then you can look at the range of the conversion in those keywords that converted. And then based on that range, you can increase or, you know, not so much increase the individual keyword bits. Does it summarize?
Exactly. So traditionally, revenue per click is only something that you're calculating for keywords that have sales is traditionally what happens. And what I'm advocating for and what I've found a lot of good success with personally when I've rolled this out for clients is even for the non-converting keywords, you can still optimize those bids by figuring out what the revenue per click is for their parent entity, which is going to be the ad group, assuming the ad group has a sale. If the ad group doesn't have a sale, you would then want to jump up to another tier, which would be a campaign. And then if the campaign doesn't have a sale, then you want to jump up a higher tier and look at a group of campaigns, campaigns that you could group them by portfolios in the ad console. So you'd want to reference the portfolio. Hopefully those campaigns are grouped by similar products that do have a similar average order value, as well as similar conversion rate, because you're going after similar keywords. That'll be really important for creating basically another set of data points and benchmarks to help inform these campaigns with low data. And then the ultimate, you know, tier, I guess, would be if the whole portfolio has low data, you then will look at all of your sponsored product campaigns as a whole, or all of your sponsored ads campaigns as a whole. So that's the way I like to do it. So I call it like climbing the ladder, where if you've got a keyword with like, you know, 1,000 clicks and 100 sales, heck, just do the revenue per click on that keyword, take that keyword sales, the keywords clicks, multiply that by your target A cost, good to go. But then when you've got these one click, no sales scenarios, and you know, it's like, how do I calculate here? You start working your way up. Use the ad group if the ad group has enough data. If not, go campaign. If not, portfolio. If not, all campaigns. And for me, just being able to go down and be deep and granular when possible lends itself to really good results. And then having that system in place of kind of climbing that hierarchy of individual data points keeps all of our bid adjustments extremely dialed in and relevant to those current time periods. So even when we're using like a really short time window, like 7 day or 14 day to because there's a, you know, big trends happening as we're warming up to a big season or cooling off of a season, we can use shorter time frames and still have a lot of data confidence with increasing these bids on these keywords with low data, where we're going to increase these bids because we're trying to get more visibility, trying to get more clicks, but we can increase with confidence knowing that we're not going to run into that scenario where we now have 90% of our keywords are all low data, low spend, and absolutely bleeding us to death. You know, that's the situation that we're trying to avoid. And that's where this situation comes in place, where you can increase bids on those low visibility or low data keywords with confidence by having those ceilings in place.
Yeah. So what do you say to the idea of removing the keywords that don't generate sales in terms of what is a good time frame to allow to make that conclusion?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. So at what point do you archive a keyword or negate a keyword? I personally am only going to run into two scenarios where I'm archiving or negating a keyword. Number one is going to be the keyword simply just not relevant. It snuck in there somehow. You know, I'm selling tennis rackets and this is a keyword for tennis shoes and it's just not what I am selling, not what I'm promoting, and has no sales history. We're going to negate that. But if there is a keyword that like at one point it converted or it's gotten a couple of sales here and there, but it's averaging a 1% conversion rate compared to like our 10% average for the account, I would still, a lot of people just say, if the conversion rate's really low, I'm going to archive it. I'm not as big of a believer in that. I am more in favor of just optimizing that bid because you can always optimize a bid down to like as low as 2 cents and perhaps still get some visibility. I mean, you might not, but I have had a lot of scenarios. In fact, I've got one account right now where they have a lot of super upper funnel keywords that are all really low. We're talking 0.5% conversion rate, 1% conversion rate, that are all really low data. You know, they only get like, you know, a few clicks, and cumulatively these campaigns have just an abysmal conversion rate. But the bids on all of them are like 2, 4, 5 cents, like really cheap clicks. And cumulatively, they're actually profitable for us. Cumulatively, we're driving, you know, a couple $1,000s in sales within our target ACoS. And someone else would have, you know, any other, you know, or not any other, most people, if they're seeing these keywords with low data, they're going to go through and archive them because it could be the scenario where, you know, when they, at the time they looked at it, the ACoS was really high, and they just saw high ACoS, low conversion rate, rather than thinking, I can optimize this bid and get fewer sales, albeit profitably, they decided to just negate and lose all those sales altogether. That's how I handle those scenarios. If there is a keyword that hasn't gotten any sales at all whatsoever, and it has a lot of clicks, let's just say 100 clicks and no sales, I would look at the keyword like, is it a relevant keyword? If it's not relevant, of course, negate it or archive it. If it is a relevant keyword, then I would want to figure out, I'd be more concerned about the product listing and why have we not converted after 100 clicks? Why have we not converted if this keyword is indeed relevant? What's wrong with the product listing? The thing to keep in mind, if you negate that keyword and just to kind of save you money for the time being, and then you go fix your product listing and you forget that you negated that keyword, then like, even if you start adding that keyword, trying to go after it, it's never going to get any traffic because you negated it and you might not remember that you negated it. So I never like negating irrelevant keywords, and I don't even negate based off of just hard data. People will just say, if it's less than this conversion rate or above this ACoS, negate, and they just go with it. For me, I use those same thresholds, but to me, those are triggers to review, and I review those keywords, and I don't automate like negations. I only do things manually, and those are good thresholds and triggers for me to just say, this is stuff that needs a QA, and then I'll look into them.
So what you are saying is, give it some time if you feel that they are relevant. Then that may pay off.
You can optimize those bids, is what I would say. Whenever you're running these calculations, as long as your bids, I've had this scenario where you run the calculation, the bid says you should be bidding like 0.5 cents or you should be bidding 1 cent, and it's less than Amazon's minimum bid. And I'm like, I literally can't even go this low. This is how bad the conversion rate is on this keyword or this product. Then yeah, those ones all just kind of like archive. But I mean, those are like, these are very, very extreme examples in very abnormal accounts where I see those happen. So yeah, in general though, I think bidding can solve a lot of problems if you get the bids right, because you can use bidding to control your ranking. You can use it to control your profitability as well as just manage overall investment levels.
So after optimizing and giving it enough time and keywords still not converting, obviously they have to go at some point, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is no coming out of it. What is a good time frame to make that judgment call?
Yeah, as long as you have, I guess. 90 days is usually a pretty good one, but in that case, Yeah, if you are looking for stuff that, if you're just trying to find those certain thresholds of like, this thing's got 1,000 clicks and no sales, you know, in those scenarios, I think longer time frames are better. You're not so concerned with the seasonality as you are. Like when it comes to trying to calculate keyword bids, you want to be a bit more time conscious of your date range as these trends are ebbing and flowing. But if you're just trying to capture stuff that's irrelevant year round to your product, then yeah, the longer date range you can use, the better.
Yeah. And also, is it a time frame or is it the number of clicks that it will get? Because it may not get enough clicks, but it may spend 10 days for three clicks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would definitely recommend using super long time frame. And then in terms of the number of clicks, that would be something that would be for you to decide. I like, as a helpful kind of starting point, I look at my average clicks to conversion, which is basically just the inverse of conversion rate. So instead of doing orders divided by clicks, we're doing clicks divided by orders. So if you had a 10% conversion rate, that would mean on average, it takes 10 clicks to get that conversion. So I would say if anything's underperforming this threshold by 2 or 3 times worse performance, meaning instead of just, you know, getting 10 clicks and not converting yet, if it's got to 20 clicks or 30 clicks and it's already pacing to be 2 to 3 times worse than average, those are going to be good indicators for me that we should take a look at this keyword and see if this is something irrelevant. Same applies to search terms too, by the way. If you're digging through your search term reports, you could do all this as well. But yeah, those are going to be good candidates to look at for pausing, archiving, negating, and yeah, 2 to 3x worse is kind of a good starting point.
So I want to bring another metric into this. Customer acquisition cost.
Yeah, it's a great one.
First, tell us how you calculate it, and then how do you factor that into this?
Yeah, so the I like the CPA, the cost per acquisition, is the metric I usually use, which is just your spend divided by orders. So how much do you have to spend to acquire that one sale? And kind of like before, we were talking about how like to manage your ACoS, which is just a spend to sales ratio, we're trying to do that on a cost per click basis or a click by click basis. So trying to get those CPCs lined up with those RPCs, right? Now we're taking it to the order level. So now what we're trying to do is figure out, okay, our cost per order compared to our average order value. So, you know, we're still trying to find that balance there. So this is where, if you're trying to figure out how much should I be spending to attain one order, simply put, it's just going to be whatever your average order value is. Now, you know, this is where things get a little weird. You could use just your unit sales price, but we might know that at least on the ad console, you might be averaging 1.5 units per order. So the actual total sales per order will be a little bit higher, but I like to use that average order value rather than trying to dive into the individual units and sales prices and all that, just because it's readily available in the ad console. So, you know, if this ad grouper campaign has a $10 AOV, then your target A cost, let's just say, is 30% of that. That would mean your target cost per acquisition is about $3. So you can spend up to $3 before you start, you know, to try to get that order. If a keyword's already spent $3 and doesn't have any orders yet, then you know that's a very clear sign. Like, let's say a keyword has $4 to spend, no sales, and you have that $10 AOV and you know your target A cost is 30%. You know your target cost per acquisition is $3. You know $4 is spending too much. Doesn't mean pause or archive that keyword. It just means the CPCs for those keyword are too high given your average order value and your average conversion rate, because it hasn't converted yet on this keyword for however many clicks it's gotten, no conversions yet. So we know the CPC is too high. We have to calculate that bid or lower that bid to mitigate that. So you want to get the keyword bid to a place where on the day that it converts, if it converts, when it converts, you'll be at the target A cost. You can, there's another way to do that. It gets really technical, but there's another way to still use this whole same revenue per click methodology, you incorporating ad groups and campaign data to calculate bids in these scenarios that I call the high spend non-converting scenario, which is exactly that, where you got a keyword where the spend has exceeded your target cost per acquisition and hasn't gotten a sale yet.
Well, I was talking to a former Amazonian, and we were talking about metrics, and he said, well, there are two types of metrics, input metrics, output metrics. So he says, you can't really control your business by looking at the output metrics. You have to look at the input metrics.
What's an example of input versus output?
So that's exactly the interesting part, because he referred to ACOS. He said, ACOS, look at the ACOS, and then based on the ACOS, you decide certain things. And I said, but isn't ACOS an output metric? And he said,
right, I would think.
Yes, but that output metric becomes an input metric when it becomes the factor to decide the bids and everything else. That's what this conversation that we are having is really articulating, this whole idea that the ACOS is in fact both input metric and output metric, because it drives the input metric, which is the bid, right? Ultimately, bid is everything. Bid is driving your ACOS, it's driving your traffic, your clicks, it's driving your impression share or whatever. Everything is driven by the bid. And as yet, what is controlling the bid? ACOS.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And then by deciding what the bid should be, then you've got the ACOS. So maybe it's the targeted ACOS versus actual ACOS. That's one to separate. But you know, something else that I noticed, you mentioned several times, and that I was trying to, because I tried to come up with my own metrics to get a sense, because usually you can like combine a bunch of metrics and then come up with a composite metric, and that tells you what it is. And that was the average value of a click. And my approach was simple. If you take the entire number of sessions, look at your business report, and then look at your total sales divided by sessions, that's your click rate. And then if you track that over time, you can see how well you are performing, how efficiently you are performing, or I should say, how high value your traffic is. So, of course, if you go spending money or you drive external traffic and that doesn't convert, that metric is going to take a fall. And then you can actually break that down to multiple buckets for the clicks and the sales that each bucket generates, down to each campaign type, you know, product, sponsored product, display, whatever, and as well as your external traffic, if you're using attribution. So each and every one of those, what do you think about that idea?
The value of a session or sales per session, that's very conceptually, I mean, conceptually, I think almost identical to the whole revenue per click concept. It's basically the same thing. But that is a great point, because when you do that, the sales per session, and try to figure that out, that also gives you a good indicator of even like off Amazon traffic, you know, or anywhere, like just, yeah, what's the value of eyeballs on a product page. And typically what you'll see happen is if you do suddenly start shifting to a lot of super upper funnel traffic and driving a lot of really cold traffic to those product pages, you will see like those conversion rates come down just in total, as there's a lot more of those sessions are driven by colder traffic, which will lower your total sales per session. That overall, what do you call these metrics? These compilation metrics?
Composite,
yeah. So yeah, those composite metrics. But the beautiful thing about that is that you then adapt. You then realize, okay, now with a lot more colder traffic, we've seen how this trend has changed. Exactly, you adapt.
Yeah. So I like to create my own to get a sense of what's going on. Of course, they are not necessarily input metrics, but also in order to get to those, which input metric you need to work on, you need to get an idea of where you are, and that's done by looking at the output metric. So this is It's a fascinating conversation. So yep. We can go on. You know, I love numbers, and you know, obviously, same for you. We can go on forever, but we're running out of time. So, what I want to do now is enough business talk. I want to get to know you, and then let's see what kind of a man becomes obsessed with numbers and then fixing bidding systems. How long was it that before you realized that I'm not going to do this HR boring work?
Yeah, before we dive into that, I just want to congratulate anybody who's made it this far in the episode so far. If you haven't shut me off, if you heard me just start rambling about all these metrics and things and trying to use my hands to visualize numerators and denominators. Congratulations. Great work.
Well, you know what it is. It's, you know, somebody said this a long time ago. In order to win the race, first you have to finish it. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly.
Amazon is a race. So if you're not able to stay with it, you know, it's a problem. So maybe that's something that you want to look into. And, you know, you gave fair warning. This is all going to be all about. But these efforts pay off.
Yeah.
And our listeners are fairly loyal. They get great value. And I look at our average play times and things like that. They stay with it. And also, nice. They come back. If they leave, they come back.
Yeah.
So tell us about yourself. Take us back to your beginning. So where did you grow up and what kind of things were you interested in as a kid?
Yeah, so I'm born and raised in California outside of for 3 years of my childhood. From age 2 to 5, my family was in Ethiopia. My parents were missionaries out there starting some orphanages for children and education for some, like, my dad was like training pastors down there. So, you know, spent a few years out in Africa, and then came back, and the rest of my life was basically all just California, born and raised, born in San Diego, grew up in LA County. And now I've been living in Orange County for the past, like, I don't know how long, since 2016, and it's 2024. So like 8 years, been living in Orange County. Absolutely love it here. This now feels like home to me, but I was always, all through like junior high school, college, actually not really college, just because I didn't have to take any math classes there, but all through junior high and high school, I always loved math. I always found myself geared towards that. In fact, I think it's a funny story that when I was in high school, I was in this really, really boring U.S. history class. And I say it was really boring just because the teacher did not care about the class. He was like the basketball coach, but he like had to teach a class. So he would always just like, yeah. So he would, every class session, he would just be like, all right, shut up and read your textbooks and do your homework, and just like a rude guy. And it was very boring. And then this kid behind me, named Will Chang, he was in like calculus BC, which there's like these different levels. There's like calculus regular, then calculus AB, and then BC. And I was just in like pre-calc, which is like a whole like couple years ahead of this kid, but we're the same age. So he's like 2 years ahead of me on math. And I saw him doing his homework, and I was like, dude, that looks crazy cool. He's doing these like integrals and stuff. And I was like, can you teach me how to do that? I just thought it looked cool, you know? So he's sitting there and he's like teaching me calculus in this class. And I get really excited. So I go buy the textbook, and I like start taking, you know, calculus on my own, and having Will teach me all these things. And point being, I don't know what's wrong with my brain. I thought it was so interesting. And we would always get in trouble from the history teacher, because he'd be like, thought we were like, you know, we're out here being more productive than what he's doing. But I thought that was funny. But I never actually pursued math any more than, like, you know, I took calculus, like the honors or whatever it's called, AP, Calc AP in high school. And because I counted as a college credit, I didn't have to take any math in college. So I never took math again. That was just kind of like the end of my math career. And then I ended up working, doing construction industry as a corporate trainer, just because like I'm a good kind of public speaker and talker and teacher, I guess. So that's what I was doing, is I was just like teaching and training people at this company. And eventually I found PPC. I was like, oh, cool. It's like, it's kind of mathematically minded. Yeah. For me, it's like, I wish that we could get more technical. Like, I wish there was a way to implement like integrals and all these advanced models. There might be a way, but so far from what I've seen, it's really just multiplication and division is going to get you to where you need to go.
I give you something to look into. If you get into time series calculations,
mm-hmm.
Then that's when you get that sexy stuff.
Did
It's
you
all
call it the
about
sexy stuff?
yeah, because the time series calculations are it takes into account, you know, all kinds of things, and there's the deviations and blah blah. So that's where you have those different kind of calculations. But
Yeah.
talk about math. So I was watching this show. It's interesting stuff. There's a show called Young Sheldon. You
Oh
seen
yeah,
that?
is it from Big Bang Theory?
It's the Big Bang Theory prequel.
Like
It's
prequel.
about
No, I haven't seen Big Bang Theory or Young Sheldon.
I mean, it's pretty good. So it's about the guys, you know, the weird guy in the show in Big Bang Theory, Sheldon, his childhood. So he was a genius. He starts college when he's 11. Of course, there's a professor who takes him in. He was attending the professor's classes without even getting into college. And then in the end, the college says, you know, we want to admit you here, you know, as a student. So he starts college. And anyway, he comes up with an idea to create a database. And he's pitching the idea to different scientists. So the moral of the story is this crazy idea. He goes to his professor. He says, what do you say if I take this idea to everybody, to all the other academics? And he says, oh, no, that's a very bad idea. And he says, why? They are scientists, aren't they? And they are also in physics and mathematicians. And he says, no, 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 they will all make fun of you. And they'll say you are wrong. But if you go to mathematicians, they will not only tell you are wrong, but they will also prove it.
Oh, nice.
Math has that, you know, 0-1 approach, right? So it's
right.
But what I want to know is how come somebody who is into math so much ends up in HR?
Well, my degree in college was in Bible, so it wasn't. I got my degree in biblical studies. Thought I wanted to be like a youth pastor, and then was hanging out with junior hires and realized this is not for me. I can't handle these junior hires. And so then I tried to get a job in like the secular world and had no employable skills outside of public speaking. And so that was how I ended up in HR, just doing corporate training, just a lot of teaching and training. I mean, it was a pretty good job. I loved my boss. He really invested in me, and yeah, overall that was a great, wonderful job and great experience. But it was trapped in a cubicle with bright fluorescent lights and no windows scenario.
I can. So anybody else? You have any brothers, sisters? Anybody else in the family like you with numbers?
Yeah, I got with numbers. I got two older sisters. One is like she's just smart in general. So she, you know, did well in math and stuff, but she had to like study. That's the other thing, is like I never studied for any of these things, like outside of like obviously like when you're first learning it, but I didn't have to, like, after you go over the lesson, for me at least, it was like once the lesson's taught, I was like, makes sense. And then I would just like, you know, never have to review it again, just because to me, and the same was with physics. When I took physics AP, I didn't have to remember that like force equals mass times acceleration. I didn't have to like memorize that formula, because I could like just think through conceptually like what makes sense, like, and like, you know, just play with my, like, push my hands when I'm applying the force, I'm like kind of accelerating, like you just think through it, you know, until it all makes sense and figure stuff out. So I mean, that's just the way my brain has always worked, is that like if things click and make sense, then it sticks. If things don't make sense to me, then like it doesn't stick. So in general, my memory is pretty bad on a lot of things, but at least like if there is something that makes sense to me, it's just like, got it, understand it, don't need to review it anymore.
Yeah. Well, it's obviously you found your place, so that's what matters, right? So those jobs that you do, it's not really, you know, it's a job, but not your career. So this is your career, obviously.
Yeah. And yeah, when it got into the Amazon space, yeah, I realized how, I don't know if easy is the right word to use, how possible it was to really excel and really exceed clients' expectations. Cause I realized there's a little bit of there's a big demand for like PPC managers and really low supply. And it seems to me that a lot of agencies are, you know, can't grow fast enough, can't scale fast enough to meet all these, especially since 2020, right? With when that really forced a lot of businesses on into the e-com side of things. And because they can't grow and hire fast enough and train fast enough, they're forced to hire under-experienced or underqualified PPC managers. And then they're also forced to rely super heavily on automation tools that are going to basically handle all of the bidding optimization for them. And I'm someone who's never wanted to do any kind of bid automation. I think there's a lot of reasons why manual can outperform automation. And so that's always been my biggest passion. So whenever I take on a new client and I just take them from having an underqualified manager where everything was automated with very little managerial input and oversight, and I just start managing bids manually through the ways that we just discussed, and they see that their ACoS instantly comes down and while their sales are going up, and they thought that was impossible because all their life they've been told you can't have ACoS come down and sales go up simultaneously. And it's like, yeah. Oh, it happens. Like, it's really cool. And it's a really good feeling to be helping real people.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was just going to say to you. It's knowing numbers, liking numbers, working with numbers is one thing, but you have jumped into running your own business, an entrepreneur. That's a whole different world. So why do you do that is the question. So in your case, I just heard you say you like helping people. So numbers are just facilitating that, I think. Would that be right?
Yeah, I just started a project with some friends and kind of people I've worked on a project with previously, but it's called AdLabs. This is a software that I started like 6 months ago. And to me, it's just a major passion project because I was unsatisfied with any of the existing softwares out there because everybody wanted to automate my bids and I didn't really want that. But managing bids manually on spreadsheets and bulk sheets was way too slow. And I was begging people, I was begging like every software I tried, I was like, can I please calculate my bids this way? Because everything I just talked about in this episode, like this is how I want to manage my bids. I want to have a specific bid ceiling for each ad group. Like I want to be doing that. I want one big blanket bid ceiling that governs everything. Like I want to be more specific. Can I customize this? Can I do anything? And nobody would do it. So I said, fine, I'll do it myself. I reached out to a few developers that I knew in Europe and pitched them this idea of like, hey, I think there could be some demand for a software that's kind of like semi-automatic management system that's not fully automated, but it's not fully manual. It's kind of this hybrid in between. And we started building it mainly just because I needed it. And Andrew, who was on here like a few weeks ago on this podcast as well, like we needed this tool. And we had talked to other agency owners who needed this tool. People are sick of spreadsheets and they're sick of automation. We needed something in between. So this is kind of like, it's basically a spreadsheet, but it's like Google Sheets connected to the Amazon API. So there's no upload, download. And, you know, we have everything we just talked about calculating those bids, but then the manager can actually QA everything before they send it live and they can tweak things and override things. And it's a really nice thing. So for me, the decision to do this was easy because there was a lot of passion on it. There's a lot of frustration with the incumbents that, you know, you go to customer support and like fix this, do this. It never happens. Things are broken. And so it's kind of just like, for me, it's a beautiful outlet of all my frustrations. Like, yes, when this was broken, like we're going to fix this. And, you know, it's fun, you know?
So it's the necessity that draw you to this.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, the mother of all inventions is the necessity.
Okay. Yeah.
Except that's half of it. Most people don't know the other half. Fathered by knowledge and experience.
Ooh, nice. So why are there two fathers?
Well, the thing that I don't know if that's happened to you yet, but if not, you're going to find out soon that being an entrepreneur, running your own business is really very little to do with addressing a necessity, even doing what you are passionate about. You spend a lot of your worries and concerns and your time and energy on other things, which yep. becomes a lifestyle. So my question to entrepreneurs is, knowing what you know about what it's like being an entrepreneur, why do you do it? So that's the ultimate question. Why do entrepreneurs do what they do? And partly what I try to uncover on this podcast. I think I detected a little bit, a few things, and I don't know. Tell me if I'm getting close. So I heard you mention your studies, your biblical studies.
Yeah, that was my undergrad, yep.
Yeah, so there is a whole philosophy behind doing those studies, right? So it's helping and other things. I also heard you mention this client that ACOS was getting better and more sales and that, and it was a nice feeling to help. So I think, yeah, of course, by addressing a necessity, you are naturally helping, but it sounded to me like what's driving you more is that helping concept, helping people, obviously using the skill you have and leveraging that to offer that help is, I think, something that is somewhat motivating.
Yeah, it's definitely a big part of it. Yeah, I'm definitely a people person. Love talking to people, love building relationships. And it is really cool when we do kind of, you know, we've just started this project, but we've onboarded about 100 people so far to the app, and seeing people's reactions to it and them just being like in disbelief too. There've been a couple of people who when they hear what it is, they'll say, okay, well, do you also optimize placement settings too and incorporate those placement settings into the bids? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. And they're like, all right, we'll believe it when we see it. Like, we don't think you do, because we've demoed every tool out there. None of them do this. Or if they claim to do it, like, it's not doing it well, or there's no visibility for the managers to see how or why these changes are being made. So they're like, and then when they actually see it and it's exactly what they've also been dreaming of, it's awesome. You know, it really is cool to just, yeah, to know that you're filling a bit of a gap in the space.
So it makes you feel like superior to be able to deliver something like that, no?
Yeah, more than anything for me, the biggest thing that I love is I love having a thought in the shower and then it becomes reality like a few months later down the road. And having this like extremely talented team of developers who are just executing on things and also question me and challenge me on like everything that I, you know, every idea I give them, they challenge the heck out of it, which is amazing. I love it. It makes us much, much better and stronger as a team versus them just like following orders.
But
to me, it's really a creative thing. It's a bit of not like art, but kind of like, that's why artists like to create. Like, I like music. I do some songwriting and stuff. So for me, like, this is really just a creative outlet of having these ideas, casting the vision, and then seeing it built. To me, that's the biggest, like, rewarding feeling in the world, the biggest dream job. And then the fact that it's also like also what everyone else loves and is enjoying together. Yeah, that's all of it combined is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, you're definitely doing very well and enjoying the process. That's the most important. So it's whatever makes you happy. I think that only brings productivity and gets you gets better and better. Well, great. So, Stephen, tell us, how can people reach you? Share your contact information with us.
Yeah, LinkedIn is where I'm checking my messages most frequently. So send a connection request there. If you do send a connect request, you can include a message. Mention the Amazon Legends podcast, just because I get a lot of spam messages. So that'll help me kind of filter through who should I actually be taking the time to read the messages. So hit me up on LinkedIn. And then you can also go to adlabs.app to find our product. There's a free version of it. So if you want to test it out for free, there's no time constraints. It's everything in there. So you could see if it works for you, because I know a lot of what we just talked about with those bid ceilings and all that kind of stuff, it's complicated. Oh, and last thing too, if you really want to go in depth on all that, that was a lot of kind of drinking from the fire hose. I think the information we discussed, we break things down a little more granularly on our own podcast, that Amazon Ads podcast. So you can search that as well. Those are probably the best channels to either learn more or get in touch with me.
Great. I'm sure people will take a look and reach out. Yeah, I love this kind of conversation. I love numbers. They don't lie, and it's always a good way to figure out what's going on. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you for being here.
Awesome. Thanks, Nick. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And this brings us to the end of another episode, and I'll see you on the next one.
If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the episode, and share it with someone you think would benefit from it too.